all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Good day. I'm Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today here on Veterans Radio, and thanks for joining us. We've got some interesting stories for you. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web, veteransradio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, PuroClean. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. It provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, biohazard cleanup. It also has a focus on veteran franchisees. You can learn more about them by going to puroclean.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Master Sergeant Earl Plumley. We are very honored to have him on. He is a recipient of the Medal of Honor. Master Sergeant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
No, it's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to tell your story and promote some of the things you're working on, but it's sort of, let's go all the way back to the beginning. How did a nice kid like you from Oklahoma find himself in the military?
I came from a military family, so I was always very interested in service, and I was all, you know, whatever movie was out in Hollywood, glamorizing certain parts of it, that's what I was going to do. And then, you know, I joined the National Guard in high school. It kind of lit the fire, and then, you know, ended up in the Marine Corps. And, I have ADHD, and I can't stick at anything too long, and decided to run myself through the Army and see how that was.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating start here. It is what I wanted to talk about is, you jump into the Oklahoma Army Guard, I think you're at 17 years old, and after graduating high school, move into the Marine Corps for 8 years. What were you chasing?
I was chasing an adventure, and I was chasing a challenge. So the National Guard was kind of a great way to get me started led me to validate my belief that I was destined to serve. But I was really looking for that deeper challenge and the adventure. You know, the Oklahoma National Guard was neat, but as I, you know, got out of high school, I wanted to see other parts of the world, and the Marine Corps promised me that and delivered that.
I think a lot of youth kind of wonder if they measure up, and you know, do I measure up to what my father's generation or my grandfather's generation was? Was that a little bit of this as, hey, the National Guard's okay, but do I measure up to the Marine Corps?
Yeah, definitely. There was a piece of that. My father was a Marine, and my grandfather before him was a Marine. And of course, they both told me not to join. I took that as a personal insult. Like, they don't think I'm tough enough? I'm definitely going to show them.
Yeah, that's how that works, isn't it? Reverse psychology. Yeah. You did the Marine Corps for 8 years, and then in 2009, you joined the United States Army. But you joined the Army with something in mind, I suspect, right? Again, measuring up.
So yeah, I joined the Army as an 18 X-ray contract, which means you go straight to Special Forces selection. I was, you know, prepared for that. As a force reconnaissance Marine, it was not super challenging to pass selection. The Q course caught me off guard. But I was a civilian for 12 hours. The afternoon where I was released from the Marine Corps, that next morning, I joined the Army.
It's an unusual and interesting and probably telling sequence of events that gets you into the Army Special Forces. You have, I think, a total service record of about 24 years along the way. If they say you got promoted to Master Sergeant in the U.S. Army, but also along the way, we're moving into the 2000s and we're going to find ourselves post 9/11 with fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us a little bit more about your career.
So my very first deployment in the Marines, the nation transferred to a war footing. So I was having a cool adventure traveling around Asia, and then woke up on the morning of September 11th, 2001, and I was in the military at war. And the rest of my career, nearly every point of my career was spent fighting the war on terror, which was it was unique, gratifying. I'm glad I got to serve my country, and heartbreaking. I think at least once a year, I buried a friend in service to the country. So that was also you spend a piece of yourself doing that.
Well, your time in the Marines had you in, I believe, Iraq and Anbar province, if I've got the notes right here.
I lived out of Al Asad both trips. And we had a direct action mission as a force reconnaissance Marine, attacking the mid-level members of Al Qaeda. So it was very rewarding work. A lot of times you kind of have to be subjective about how valuable your service is. Both of those trips, I did not have to really look around to see if it was valuable. Every night I did something that was profoundly valuable and rewarding.
One of the things you've commented about, and we're talking to Medal of Honor recipient Earl Plumlee, you've talked about the diversity of people that you served with, both in the Marines and in the Army. Talk a little bit about why that's important to you.
Well, to me, as an American, I think that every citizen should get the chance to serve, and it's not always possible. And I should want to serve. And I always thought it was really neat to see the full cross spectrum of the United States. And I always said, after boot camp, the group of friends I had made there, when we got put our civilian clothes to go out in town, it was a hilarious picture because we had cowboys out of Texas, farmers out of Kansas, surfers out of Southern California, and kids out of Boston and New York, and none of us dressed even remotely the same.
And you thought to yourself, I ain't in Oklahoma anymore.
Yeah, I'm definitely not in Oklahoma anymore.
As you continue to serve and you were sent into Afghanistan, there's a particular battle in August of 2013 at Forward Operating Base Ghazni. Tell us what happened that day that sort of has certainly changed your life.
It's definitely changed my life. Taliban decided to make an example out of our camp and do a spectacular attack. They're hoping to kill enough Americans that maybe we would decide to leave. Unluckily for them, my unit was having a change of command, so we had triple the number of Green Berets that would normally be on installation. And they initiated the attack with a 4,000-pound truck bomb, and 15 members of their unit with suicide vests and brand-new Chinese rifles, stormed through the breach they'd made, and unfortunately found me and my friends waiting for them on the other side of that wall.
This is one of these things that I don't care how much you think about it, you can't practice this. It's reactive. And how did you and the other Green Berets, Special Forces soldiers, react here?
Well, we didn't know the nature of the attack. And we knew with a bomb that size, there was undoubtedly going to be injuries and possibly a fight. So we grabbed our stuff and moved to the point of conflict. And, unfortunately, the Taliban didn't tell us exactly what they were doing. So we parked right in the middle of them.
Yeah, another one of those brilliant one of those brilliant decisions by who's driving the vehicle, right? Stop here.
Yeah, stop here. What are these guys doing? And then they all started shooting us up.
Part of this was the insurgents were dressed in Afghan National Army uniforms, if I understand it.
Yeah, so they'd tried attacks like this several times, and they were always changing the techniques that they were using. And this one, they decided that they could never pass as American, but they definitely looked like Afghans. So they used that to get deep into the camp without being fired upon.
And let me just read from the Military Times article. Quote, without regard for his own safety, Staff Sergeant Plumley hopped out of the vehicle using his body to protect its driver while drawing his sidearm. He fought off two attackers, was wounded by a detonating suicide vest before he could get to adequate cover. He killed two insurgents in his field of fire, but at least eight were still firing on American forces. He left his position with only his pistol and advanced on the enemy alone, finally reaching a fellow soldier behind cover. After what must have seemed like hours under intense enemy fire, he and others, the other soldier, no longer alone, withdrew to join other American and coalition troops who were preparing a counterattack, end of quote. And both an American and a Polish soldier were killed in this insurgent attack, as it's reported. I'm not going to ask you to talk about this, Master Sergeant. It just sort of seems that I'll let the article and your actions speak for itself. But coming out of that incident, you were awarded the Silver Star, and subsequently it was upgraded to the Medal of Honor and presented to you by President Joe Biden in December of 2021. Nobody goes into the military for the decorations, right?
That was never a big part of my plan. I was chasing the stuff that you would that makes your uniform look fancy, like jump wings and dive bubbles, and going for all the cool schools. But it was never my plan to get a Purple Heart or a Valor Award.
Yeah, nobody should seek the Purple Heart.
Yeah, if your plan is to get the Purple Heart, call me and let me talk you down. That is a terrible plan.
As time moved on, and as I said, the battle occurred in 2013, and 8 years later, it's the Silver Star gets upgraded to the Medal of Honor. This is, I think, most people don't understand is what a rigorous process getting an upgrade or getting the Medal of Honor being awarded to you is. Can you talk a little bit about that period of time where, hey, these other guys are talking about this should be upgraded, and your reaction to all of that?
So I, at first there was a ton of interest and scrutiny, and then the award got downgraded to the Silver Star, and I thought that would be the end of it, and especially as an E6, I remember being profoundly relieved that it got downgraded. I was terrified for the eventuality of having to wear the Medal of Honor. And, the members of the Pentagon and the upper levels of the Army would call me from time to time asking for clarification over the years. And I kind of got used to it. And it was, about 6 months before I got the medal, the phone calls, changed in nature. And they quit asking me about the battle or asking me for access to people for witness statements. And they started asking me what I was doing and where I was going to be. And that's when I started to kind of think that something was up. But honestly, I was, I remember, you know, pursuing my career as a Silver Star recipient, and the incredible scrutiny of the Medal of Honor was off of me, and I was just really happy to get back to work as a Green Beret and have my career.
I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, that the Medal of Honor is sort of thrusted upon you, isn't it?
It is, and it's a, you know, it's an incredibly humbling thing, and it's nerve-wracking. You know, the rest of the time that I spent in uniform until now, you're scrutinized in a positive way, but everyone is always going to remember what you said and emulate your behavior, and that can be, you know, that can be overwhelming.
There is a Medal of Honor Award Process Review Board. The first kind of look at it, the board said, hey, the guy's just doing his job. And it didn't, under that review, reach the level of a Medal of Honor. It was subsequently looked at again and moved up, upgraded to the Medal of Honor. You at some point, get a call telling you it's been upgraded, and let's start working on coordination to meet the president and receive the award. Very few men will ever get a chance to go through that month or two where that's going on. Tell us what's going on during that period.
So I got a call from the president. He told me I was going to be getting the Medal of Honor, and you know, spoke to me for kind of a long time. In my opinion, I don't know how long people usually get to talk to the president. But immediately after that, you know, I talked to a woman from the Pentagon, and she was like, "Hey, this is still a tightly held thing. We don't want to tell anybody, but we also don't want you getting deployed or sent into a training environment where you won't be able to get reached, because the day was still not set after the president called me." And I told him, "Yep, yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it. I got all that handled," and hung up on her, and then immediately deployed on what would be one of my last deployments.
Well, the logistics always work out, and there is a lot of logistics to get you, friends, family, members of the unit into Washington for this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when we finally got warned, hey, you need to be at the White House on this day, we had about 10 days, I think, to get it done. And the Army decided I needed to wear the new service uniform, the AGSU, and I didn't have it. And they had a piece of it that would fit me at a base almost completely across the United States.
And let me say, you're not a small guy.
I'm not a small guy. I got big feet, apparently. But they put one together. My boots actually came in the evening before the ceremony, and the honor guard from Arlington, they took turns polishing my boots for me so that I could sleep. But the first time I ever put that uniform on was about an hour before I went to the White House.
Those are the little backroom things none of us see. But you do get to be in the back room and talk to the president a little bit before they open those doors and all the lights are on and the nerves really run. How was meeting the president?
It's amazing. Whether you voted for him or not, if you're meeting the president of the United States and you're not just awed, you know, I challenge you how patriotic you are. So it was really neat. The president and the first lady were, you know, very gracious to us and treated my family like $1 million. And you know, he was late because of an engagement. Obviously, the president was busy. And so we got to just kind of wander around the White House unsupervised for a few hours, which my daughter took full advantage of.
Yeah, she's got selfies and probably, you know, maybe a White House ashtray in her purse at that point.
Yeah. Well, this is a really neat sword. It's George Washington's sword. Put it down.
So I want to talk about, you used this word earlier, and so I'm going to bring it back to you. And you said, hey, I was terrified to wear the Medal of Honor. That continues to kind of roll around in your brain until it's probably becomes a bigger deal. And when they finally put the medal on you, where were you in that process? Were you still terrified, asking yourself, do I measure up? Just like you asked yourself when you jumped into the Marines?
I mean, I still do. You know, there's a Medal of Honor Society, and we have a convention at least once a year. And every time I walk into that room with the other recipients, it's always stunning to me that I belong in there with them. I think the medal, it's definitely one of those things. My actions in 2013 got me nominated for it, but you feel compelled to earn that thing every day.
One of the things, once you have been bestowed this honor, it's sort of like a knighthood, I think, everybody looks at you differently. And I know that you were a former student athlete in high school. You have an opportunity to talk to a lot of young men and women because of this honor. Tell us how you wear this responsibility on a daily basis.
So I always try to be a good steward of the profession, you know, the profession of arms. I served for 24 years and 11 months, and I was proud the day I put on the uniform, and I was just as proud the day I took it off. And I think the country is worth fighting for and worth sacrificing for. And the only thing I can do at this point is serve as a role model for people to emulate that behavior. I like to educate that you build the country doesn't build you, and you don't need a uniform to serve the country. So if something needs fixing, don't look around for somebody else to do it. Roll your sleeves up, get your hands dirty, and solve the problem and make your country a better place.
Earl, one of the things I've seen you say in the press before is about the importance of a positive mentor. Can you elaborate on that, both in your own life, but as importantly for our younger generation?
A positive role model or mentor. You find somebody that you want to emulate, somebody that you want to be, and they've already made all the mistakes. They can explain how things work, what to expect, and how to do the job better. And a role model and a mentor, if they're genuine, should always want to see you surpass them. And once you get one, it's such a rewarding experience to be on either side of that relationship. I always feel sad for somebody that never had a mentor to kind of help them figure out the best way to get to where they're going. And then for also, if you've mastered a profession and you really don't get to go hands-on with someone and make them the best person that they could be, that's its own reward that you're missing out on.
You've also made, and we're talking to Master Sergeant Earl Plumley, retired Medal of Honor recipient. You've also talked about the role the National Guard plays in bridging the gap between the military and civilian worlds. And in a time where patriotism seems to wane, recruiting seems to be down, talk to us about the importance of bridging that gap.
So, the National Guard is just such a great touch point for the federal government, the state government, and the civilian population. They truly are the bridge. When you see somebody in uniform, you kind of understand what they are. But a National Guardsman, that's somebody from your community that has chosen to take time out of their life to be there. And, in Oklahoma, every time there's a national disaster or a tornado, one of the first things that happens is they activate the National Guard and get them out there to help those communities recover. And I think it's important. That's something that the country owes you, and that's something as a people we owe the country, is to be that person that says, I know it's not safe yet, but I'm going to go out there and make it a little bit better.
We want to thank Master Sergeant Earl Plumley, retired from the United States Army, Medal of Honor recipient, for taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio today. These are always interesting stories when you hear from Medal of Honor recipients. So we hope you're enjoying this as much as we are in talking to these gentlemen. We're going to bring you another story right after some words from our sponsor.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Continuing the theme of the U.S. Army and all that it does, we're going to follow up the Earl Plumley, Master Sergeant, U.S. Army Master Sergeant Earl Plumley, with an interview we did with Brigadier General Dick Miller, retired, talking, though, about AUSA. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Brigadier General Richard S. Miller, retired. Dick Miller's a friend of Veterans Radio and has his multiple hats that he wears that bumps him into our orbit. He is the president of NVBDC, the nation's leader in certifying veteran-owned businesses. But we're having Dick on today to talk a little bit about his military career and his position as president of AUSA Region 2. Dick, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Well, let's start with this. How does a nice kid from Shelbyville, Indiana, end up spending his career in the Army? And, did you have to do this because a judge chased you into it, or what? How'd this happen?
You know, what's funny is you and I are both of the era where I know a guy actually that happened to. You got a choice, young man. But no, I end up, I graduated from school in 1970 and had no future. I mean, I didn't have the grades to go to college. I didn't want to work in a factory, and the Army was a good option for me. And so I joined, and which was rare back in 1970, and spent 2 years, was actually stationed in Germany. Surprising, I didn't get to go to Vietnam, but got out, went to school, and then in 1980, I walked in an Army recruiter and said, I want to rejoin, and I'd like to go to OCS.
And from officer candidate school to brigadier general is quite a climb. Along the way, you picked up your bachelor's degree from Indiana University and a master's degree from U.S. War College. And you've had assignments all over the world.
Right.
While Germany was the first nice country they sent you to, they found a way to send you to the sandbox a couple of times as well to balance
that out.
You know
what's funny about that is every assignment I had after that was not a very nice place. You know, from the jungles of South America to, anyway, I ended up in Afghanistan. I commanded all of southern Afghanistan out of Kandahar, and that was a nice place. But anyway, yeah, I was very, very lucky. Every assignment I had was a command assignment, which helped develop me for the next assignment. And after Afghanistan, I was a deputy chief of staff for the 38th Infantry Division, and then ultimately became the deputy commanding general.
And you spent, I think, your final tour, if you will, with the Indiana Army National Guard. That's
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was a deputy commanding general of the 38th Infantry Division. We had 14,100 roughly in that area.
Well, I might not have the math right, but it looks like you spent about, 34 years or something in one way or another in the Army?
33.
Okay. And along the way, picked up all the sort of awards and decks that one might expect, from Combat Infantry Badge up to the Bronze Star, Meritorious Service Medal, campaign medals for Afghanistan, Global War on Terrorism, Army Commendation Medals. All of that's just to sort of set you up for, I don't know, are we on chapter 3 or 4 of post-retirement, military retirement here? And your wife is saying, I kicked him out of the kitchen to go do something. I didn't know it was going to end up like this. You are spent a number of years working, I'm sure, in a volunteer position initially with AUSA. Tell us about AUSA, the Association of the United States Army.
Well, much like my military career, I started off with the Association of the United States Army as a chapter president. And that was a chapter in Indiana, of all things. And it's a very, very large. There are 1.8 million members of the association. And as a chapter, I think I had 256 people in the local chapter in Indianapolis. And then they had one in South Bend, Indiana. And then I was transferred to Michigan for a job change in 1984. And immediately was asked to join the chapter in Detroit. And that's kind of where I've been ever since. But just this is an organization, just for those who are not aware, that lobbies on behalf of the United States Army. The Army themselves cannot lobby Congress for anything. You know, it's against the law. But we have very, very strong bonds with Congress and the Senate. And that's what we do. Not me personally, but we all within that organization. But it is a volunteer organization primarily. And just like me, most of these folks that serve, they serve because they want to serve their country and they want to serve their Army.
Well, it's a really inspiring story when you look at AUSA's history, and it's a nonprofit educational and professional development association that serves not only today's total Army, active duty soldiers, reservists, National Guard, veterans, retirees, Army civilians, and their families. It's that unique voice because of those 1.8 million members who have affiliation with the U.S. Army that you have sort of some clout on lobbying or expressing, hey, how do we help the troops? And that's really the goal, isn't it?
It is, the soldiers and their families. And, you know, and by the way, the families have come into recognition in the last 15 years or so. People understand that if the soldiers aren't happy and the families aren't happy, you know, it affects their performance. The region that I'm in, or the president of this second region, we have 415,000 members across Washington, D.C., Indiana, Kentucky, Maryland, Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia. So when we go visit the Hill and we want to go see those congressmen and senators, when you have 415,000 members, they tend to pay attention to you.
And is this all on like national defense policy issues, or is it troop pay or mental health? What issues does AUSA advocate for?
It's all the above. And, you know, as a matter of fact, we were just now developing our 2025 focus areas. But if you look at it, it's readiness, it's training, it's National Guard state partnership programs, it's, you know, it's Army families, civilians, survivors, caregivers. It's anything having to do with the soldier and their family. And, you know, housing is a big thing right now. You know, there's a lot of criticisms. Some of the facilities are run down. And personnel, pay and benefits, health care, housing, child care, education, Army civilians, which, by the way, there are thousands upon thousands of Army civilians. So you take Detroit, Tarnak up there. The vast majority of the people on that base are civilians.
it's really interesting because a lot of these issues are things which the families or the troops might be reluctant to talk about up the chain of command, worrying about impacts maybe on careers. But AUSA can say, hey, this base housing has mold or these kind of problems, or you're not putting enough money into cleaning up environmental issues on base, educational funding for the schools that the Army runs is slipping. We got to, you know, pull those services up. So it gives people another way to advocate for, I guess I'd call them, sensitive issues?
Oh, yes. Just some of it's just basic day-to-day kind of stuff, but the other part of it is just that. Now, a soldier out there, just a normal soldier, is not likely going to be bringing that stuff up. Now, the AUSA, for example, down at Fort Knox is one of mine. I'll go down and meet with the commanding general at Fort Knox, and we'll discuss things. And by the way, not everything's contentious. Some of it's just basic stuff.
And supportive. Absolutely. Right. What you're able to do at AUSA is be supportive of issues that the Army wants advanced.
Yep. And then one of the big things right now, I mentioned Fort Knox, is what you call food insecurity. You know, that's the big bullet item this year is food insecurity. There are a lot of these youngsters out there that, you know, the pay isn't that great. It's not bad, but it's not that great. And then all of a sudden the guy's got a wife, couple of kids, and can't barely make ends meet. And so we're putting together a really sophisticated program for food insecurity. You got to identify them first, because a lot of these folks are, you know, embarrassed. They don't want to talk about it.
Certainly, yeah.
But that's where, for example, at Fort Knox, you know, we have a partnership with Denny's. Denny's, you know, the restaurant.
Yeah, restaurant chain.
We worked with Denny's down at Fort Knox last November to they brought in their mobile kitchen. And we fed 900 soldiers in a single day, or actually single morning. And then we gave 250 meals to the Red Cross on post. So those are some of the kind of things that the AUSA does.
Well, that again, those are the sorts of things that I think people don't, you know, it all happens quietly in the background. The mobile kitchen shows up and nobody's paying attention to how that happened or why that happened. So getting the word out like this is really important. Tell us about your Region 2, and you've told us the states involved in Region 2 for ASU. How many regions are there, and what does being president of Region 2 deal with on a national basis?
Well, we have 9 regions, and we have a Pacific region that's Alaska, Guam, et cetera, and then European region, which is Africa, Canada, Europe, Middle East, and then we have a 7th, which is out west, Scott Lingling. California is its own region, and then 5th region, Illinois. There's a lot of we're going to be looking at realigning this stuff because some of these things just don't make any sense from a geographic standpoint. But
now do each of the region presidents then sit on a national board? Is there a national governing body?
Yes.
How does that work?
Yes. Each of the regions, we have a seat on the board of directors at the national level, and we attend meetings virtually, most of the time virtually. And then once a year we have an in-person, but we all get together and we all talk about the major issues affecting our soldiers. And, you know, we actually do speaking engagements. We, you know, promote and enhance the association's goals and objectives, you know, all that sort of thing. You know, I spoke at Western Michigan's ROTC program a week ago Friday. Those are the kind of things that we try to support the overall Army.
Well, and part of this too is just to get the word out to members, the families. Hey, there's somebody who's got your back. Tons of resources are available on the AUSA website. which is simply AUSA.org. And
correct.
I noticed that, like, it has an annual meeting, and the 2025 one's going to be October in Washington, D.C. of 2025. So lots of ways to get involved, a lot of professional development opportunities, which is really interesting. And I also found it interesting. Part of this is AUSA is focused on the total Army. So there's no distinction here about, oh, you were National Guard, oh, you were reservist, oh, you
correct.
Were active duty. And that cohesiveness is really important, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Because, you know, the War on Terror just brought the units together. All the, you know, throughout the National Guard, Army Reserve, everybody. You know, when you're looking at the 38th Infantry Division, 100% of our soldiers deployed during the War on Terror, many of them multiple times.
Yeah, it really changed the way in which national defense is bolstered by the National Guard and Reserve. I don't think people fully appreciated that previously.
At one point, the 38th Infantry Division, the only organization that had more combat infantry badges was the 101st Airborne. The 38th was second.
Well, that talks about the number of tours that it had to endure during that period. I do notice that there is a area for military families to get information on how AUSA helps in that regard, so I'd certainly direct people to that. And I also see that AUSA gives out scholarships, which is something that families are always interested in as they're trying to get kids maybe through college, and possibly that's also through a trade school, that sort of thing. Tell us about those kind of hidden programs that AUSA does, Dick, that people might not know about.
Well, as you said, the military families is a big one. And the military families with scholarships and all these sorts of things. They have a woman named Holly Daly that runs the family programs. And they have stuff going on all the time. You know, training events, forums, events, family resources. If a local area wants her to come out with her team, they'll be happy to do it. Health and wellness, the big thing is military spouse career and employment. Helping a spouse become qualified to be able to, for example, help them write a resume. Now, the other big thing for families is financial readiness. There's a lot of folks out there that are, especially the young ones, are shy about asking for help. And they may need somebody to help them. Matter of fact, I know for a fact it was one of the things, helping a young lady balance a checkbook, if you will. The Child Education Coalition, there's a number of things that a soldier can reach out, and AUSA's got something for them.
Yeah, that financial readiness seems so simple, but we've all been in service with somebody who, this is the first time in their life they got a paycheck with some money, and they spend it like drunken sailors.
Yes, exactly.
Speaking of myself, and it's only later that you said, I should have put a little bit of that away, because there's a time when this ends and I got to go do something else. But again, it can be as simple as, I've never managed money before. I've never had a checkbook before. So those kind of programs are really helpful to the young Army.
Well, one of the other things that AUSA does well is they support children education. You know, the military educational system is pretty good. For example, I was, again, Fort Knox. Their high school is by comparison as good as any outside the military. You know, and they take it serious. So there's a lot of stuff that the AUSA does. You mentioned our annual event is in October. For those who don't know, every defense contractor worldwide comes to this thing. It's in the convention center downtown Washington, D.C. On average, there's 30,000 people a day come through this thing.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's huge. And we hold our annual meetings. We have a you know, like the regions, we all get together, we meet, and
if somebody's in one of these chapters or regions, and again, if you go to the website, you can find a chapter near you. How does one say, hey, you know what, I should be involved in this? How do I become a member of AUSA and get involved?
Well, you can go out to the, for example, like second region. You can just go out to the second region area, or, for example, Detroit. There's the Arsenal of Democracy chapter. And you can reach the chapters and then just call them up and say, or email, text, doesn't matter. Say, look, I really want to become a member of this. What do I got to do? They're always looking for volunteers.
Well, it's like most of life, right, Dick? The more you put into it, the more you get out of it.
Right.
As you move forward here, you're probably seeing the insides of the organization a little bit. We mentioned at the outset it's a nonprofit. So how does AUSA get funded?
Well, primarily corporate sponsors.
And that's what you'd expect. A little bit probably comes from membership dues and signing up for events.
Correct.
And paying, going to the annual meetings and those sorts of things. But it
sounds... Well, as a matter of fact, the annual meeting is a big opportunity to gain funding. But when you're looking at General Dynamics, you're looking at McDonnell Douglas and, you know, these major corporations, keep in mind, we're a lobbying organization for Congress. And so they want to make sure that we represent them as well.
Oh, certainly, yeah. That makes sense on weapon systems and things like that and the funding of programs. So we're talking to Dick Miller. He's the president of AUSA Region 2. He sits on the national board, and he's giving us some insights into what AUSA does and why it does it. Dick, any final comments here that you'd like to make to our veteran radio listeners?
Well, like I said, the AUSA is an organization supporting our soldiers, their families, pay, you know, health care, all of those things that support the United States Army. Very complex program. Professional development. I mean, you know, meetings and events, publications. By the way, they put out a really nice magazine every month. But AUSA is a long-term, done a wonderful, wonderful job supporting our soldiers, and will hopefully continue.
So I'm going to direct people to AUSA.org, hit the About Us click on button there. It'll show you where you can jump over to join AUSA. I think you'd find it very beneficial if you want to continue your service to the country and service to the United States Army by being supportive. Dick, General Miller, we appreciate the time that you've made available for Veterans Radio today to talk about AUSA.
Well, thank you again, and you know, look forward to working with you in the future.
So for all our Army friends out there, take a look at AUSA.org. See if it's right for you to maybe be an organization that you support, both with time and resources. They do good work. They also keep you pretty well informed of what's going on. And he mentioned their magazine that they put out every month. It is very informative. So if you're just a curious person, you may want to look at that as well. On Veterans Radio, we really do try to bring you a wide range of stories that we think will be of interest. But if there's something we're not touching upon, and you want more information, or you've got an idea of somebody we should talk to, let us know. We're more than glad to track down people. These are pretty turbulent times, and it's been a challenge sometimes for us to find guests who are willing to talk about what's going on in the veterans world. They don't want to get crosswise with the administration or anything like that. So we're always looking for ideas and folks who are willing to step up and speak out about their own military experiences, maybe their experiences through transition, but just the general history and stories that veterans have to tell. There's always a lot of them. And you know, they don't have to be the war stories. They may be stories about business success or failure. You'll learn sometimes more about your failures than you do by your successes. And so we bring those stories to you as well. And that's why we appreciate business sponsors like the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, and PuroClean.com. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. And they've got a lot of veterans in the business and veteran franchisees, and we get a chance to talk to them on a fairly regular basis as well. So your story ideas are always important. I do want to thank some of our sponsors again. Certainly the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, the National Vietnam Veterans of America, the VVA Charles S. Kettles Chapter, VFW Graf O'Hara Post, American Legion, Post 46, all three of those in Ann Arbor. They've been long-term supporters of the work that Dale and company have been doing. One of the new things we're doing here on Veterans Radio that I want to promote as we have a little time is to recognize that we're on a new platform, along with putting our podcasts out on all the, you know, regular platforms through an RSS.com feed, but also to iTunes and YouTube podcasts, Stitcher, etc. We are now on Reeves Across America Radio, and that platform is an aggregator of a lot of veteran-type programming. So if you like this kind of programming, we encourage you to go to readsacrossamerica.org. Go to their radio section. You may know of this organization. These are the folks who go ahead and collect donations and make arrangements to put evergreen wreaths on graves, started at Arlington National Cemetery, but really has spread out to most of the states at this point. They do that in the Christmas holiday season. And we're really proud to be on their programming now. So if you want to check them out, please do so. Our broadcasts are Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern, and also on Friday night at 7 p.m. the podcasts go up there as well. So we get a little more expansion of our network here from Veterans Radio, being able to tell these stories to a wider audience. And that's just really an honor and a pleasure. I can't tell you how much Dale and I really appreciate that. So it's one of those places you can check this out at your leisure. It's not unlike the, if you just want to focus on Veterans Radio, and we certainly don't mind if you do that, you can go to veteransradio.org and check everything out, or at our Facebook page for Veterans Radio, a lot of information being posted there as well. We have one big fundraiser every year called Radio on the River. We've had it for a number of years at the same location. But we're going to try something new this year in the greater Ann Arbor area, a place called Freedom River up in Livingston County. We think it'll be a very interesting and different opportunity to gather and support Veterans Radio. If you're in the area, it's going to be Sunday, September 28th. About noon. Keep tuned in for more information. But if you're not in the area and you want to support us, you can always buy tickets to that event or just go to veteransradio.org and click on the donate button and send us a little something. And if you're a corporate sponsor and you'd like to be spotlighted on Veterans Radio like we do for NVBDC or PuroClean, reach out to Dale or myself, Jim Fossone. We'd be glad to talk to you and see if we can make some arrangement that is mutually beneficial. Many companies started by veterans and those that support veterans want to help get these stories out, and we really do appreciate that kind of support. So looking ahead, as I said, September 28th, that's a Sunday, Radio on the River will continue as our main fundraiser. And if you're an organization out there that runs a golf outing or luncheons or galas and you are looking for organizations to support, think about Veterans Radio. We'd be glad to be in your rotation of veteran-centric groups that you support from your own independent fundraising. That'd be a fantastic opportunity for us, and we'd be glad to talk to you about how to structure that, how we can get you some information, how we can get the stories out in a little better fashion. As I said a little earlier, these are kind of interesting times because of the change in administrations and, you know, kind of how all that's going to work out for veterans, how all that's going to work out for the military. You really can't predict that stuff. You know, we don't have a crystal ball. We are talking to various experts in the field, hoping that they can give us a little more clarity. There are organizations both very pro what's going on and organizations very concerned about what's going on. So there really isn't just one vision of how this will proceed. But the one thing everybody agrees on is, hey, our veterans have already paid the price. They already signed the blank check. We owe them and have to continue with our promise to them that those who've borne the battle will take care of as a nation. And that's a little bit of where we're at the moment. So if you get a chance to run into your congressmen and women, kind of remind them, hey, there was a promise made. When these kids went overseas, they left their families. You know, there was a lot of stress and challenges. Some got injured physically, some mentally. Some really just really gave a lot, and we shouldn't turn our back on them. So that's what we do here in Veterans Radio. Tell the story, and we want you to come back. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.